Ah, weddings. They can be the most extraordinary and amazing occasions and events filled with so much wonder and joy and beauty. And they can have all kinds of bloopers associated and attached to them. So trying to make sense of what the couple and the rest of the official party were feeling in that moment when the discovery was made that the wine had run out, that's, you know, just heartbreaking to imagine what must have been going through their heads. Now, we need to understand what actually happens in a Jewish wedding in the first century. It wasn't a simple event that just took only a few hours. It began at the groom's house. Usually he'd be living still with his parents, so his parents' house. And everyone on his side of the family would gather there at his house. And then they would go on this big procession to the bride's family's house. There would be singing and dancing. There would be musicians who would accompany them. And there would be all kinds of festivities that would happen along their way to the bride's house. And then they would arrive there, and there would be this kind of formal exchange that happens. It was the last chance that the bride's parents had to reject this potential suitor, even though there'd already been this long period of betrothal at this stage. But now was the final chance that they could certify, yes, that our daughter was ready and we're prepared to give her in marriage to you. And then the procession would make their way from that house back to the groom's house, with all of the bride's family now also joining with her bridesmaids. Now this is getting towards evening, and so they would be bearing the torches, carrying, lighting the way to go back again with music, singing, dancing along the way back to the groom's house. When they arrive there, then there would be a bit of a fairly simple ceremony, because the main event will be the next day. So on the first night, they simply settle in, the bride takes her chamber, and then everybody settles in for the night. And then the next day, the main part of the celebrations will unfold with the actual exchange, the dedication of the covenant. They'd be standing on the chuppah, that there would be all of those events that are familiar perhaps from our experiences of contemporary Jewish weddings. And that would be then completed on that night, with the couple finally making their way, not to separate rooms, but to the marital bed for the consummation of the wedding, which is all part of the ceremony. You know, performance anxiety much, but anyway, all of that is there. And then the feast and the festivities don't conclude there. They continue at least for another 7 days. Although if you read the account, which we have in the book of Tobit, it indicates they go for another 13 days, or 14 days in total. Have you ever catered for a party that lasts for 14 days, having to feed the guests, house them, provide all of the wine, all of the entertainment, keeping them well occupied across a 14-day period? So it's no wonder that at some point in all of these festivities, they run out of wine. But I love the fact that it's Mary who takes the lead in this. It's Mary who sees the need. It's Mary who points out that there is this deficiency. They have no wine. She says it as simply as possible. There's no accusation. There's no saying the groom's family has stuffed up. They haven't provided enough wine for the festivities. She simply states the need. And I love that about this story, that there is no blame. There is no shame in all of this. There's just this stated need that is put out there. And then Jesus, he objects first, because everything in John's gospel is about the timing. The timing has to be just so. But he continues to respond. And what does Mary say to the servants? Just do whatever he tells you. It's a wonderful invitation for us to kind of reflect upon that. And we're told that the servants filled these 6 stone water jars. And stone is important because stone is impermeable, whereas clay is able, you have to have it glazed properly in order to prevent it from leaking. But stone, you don't have to worry about that. So for the ablutions, it was essential that you could guarantee that whatever was put inside the contents wouldn't be affected by anything on the outside from the environment and so forth. So six of these stone water jars, each carrying about 80 to 100 liters of water. Think about that. That's a lot of water. There's no tap, there's no hose to connect. So how do you fill up 500 or 600 liters of water when the only water source is most likely in the well, either outside or down the road? There might be a common well somewhere in the village. So these poor servants have to go trudging out to the well. They have to put the bucket down, lower it down. Maybe that bucket might have 20 liters of water if you're able to. That's 20 kilograms. They're able to pull that back up, empty it into the other containers, walk back to the house, empty it into these two stone jars, go back. 500 or 600 liters of water. That's a lot of trips. None of this happens instantly. There is no moment in this when there's just a flick of a switch. There is this slow process. How often have you felt like you're just going to the well, filling up the bucket, taking it back to this thing, and you don't even know why on earth you're doing this? The ablutions of the Jews happened on day one. When the guests arrived in the house, all of their hands and their feet would have been washed. It was part of the ritual of purification, part of the rite of welcome for any guests who were arriving in the house. That all happened on the first night. We don't even need these 500 or 600 liters of stone jars to be filled with water. And the servants are just scratching their heads. And yet, they're just as much a part of this miracle as anybody else. In fact, we're told they're the only ones who eventually know what is unfolding in all of this. That we're called and invited simply to do whatever he tells us. And sometimes that just feels so stupid, so overwhelming. Like, why on earth am I going back and forth to the well so many times to get this water, to bring it back, to fill up these silly stone jars? And yet somewhere in this moment, the miracle happens. We're not told exactly when. We're not told that Jesus prayed some great prayer. We're not told that he waves his hands and invokes the Holy Spirit upon the waters. It's simply something that happens, that these stone water jars once contained water, and now they contain the wine. And when the servants draw some out and take it to the steward, what does he say? Normally you serve the best wine first, and once people have had a few, then you can get away with serving the cheaper sort later. But you have kept the best to last. How often do we grow tired in our service? How often do we kind of wonder what on earth we're doing? Is it all worth it? Is it all worthwhile what we are trying to go through? How often are we just emptying our buckets into these stone jars and just not sure what on earth this is all about? And yet God in his abundance is preparing this feast. God in his abundance is reminding us that even if you aren't quite sure what's going on in this moment, there is this absolute abundance. We can sometimes imagine that God is a bit stingy, that God will only do these wonderful and amazing things if we toe the line and get everything lined up and all our ducks are lined up. Everything is perfectly ordered and structured, and we've had our 5 hours of prayer this morning and everything has been fulfilled and achieved. But this feast, this festival, reminds us that no, the God that we worship is a God of such absolute abundance. He could have just made, 20 liters of wine that I'm sure would have covered the festivities for the rest of the day. But no, just the absolute abundance of his love. We're invited into that response to a God who cares for all of our needs, a God who's looking after us, a God who's providing for us, a God who's got our backs, a God who wants us to experience the fullness of life. But he's inviting us into then the response of the disciples. But this was the first of the signs that Jesus performed, we're told, and the disciples began to believe. Were they perfect in their faith and their practice? No. But they began to believe. That's the invitation as we begin this new year, this new season of joy and wonder of discipleship, that we can begin to believe, that we can trust a little more in the abundance of God and allow that goodness to carry us and call us more deeply in our response to do whatever Jesus tells us.